Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody has had a great week. Some wild stuff going on. I hope that everybody had a great weekend at Contact in the Desert. I was not able to make it out this year. I am looking forward to it next year, being able to get out there. But I know that our good friends, Tyler Roberts was out there. He was out there with the International UFO Bureau. MUFON was out there. Our good friend Daniel Hariri was out there. All kinds of good stuff. Jason Quitt presented not only his presentation, but was on a couple panels, as well as our good friend and network head, Clyde Lewis, was out there. So hope everybody had a great time, had a good return home. Welcome back to reality, everybody, where apparently people are being set on fire in Colorado. And in addition to that, part of our topic tonight, the Nazca lines are actively in the news. Very topical. The idea that Peru reduces the Nazca line park by 42% because they're going to allow miners permits in the area. So that is kind of fascinating to me that they are reducing the size of the conserved area and opening it up to mining. Things like that. In the second part of our episode tonight, we'll be joined by our good friend Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective. He is a retired Travis County Sheriff's Department sheriff and trainer, specialized in aquatic crime scenes. We'll be talking with him about the Rainy Street murders, the so-called Rainy Street Ripper here in Austin. In our first segment, we will be joined by Jean Broida. She is the author of Unknown Objects, the Top 10 U.S. UFO Cases. She has a long history of being a psychic intuitive and AI trainer for global tech giants. She's applied both science and metaphysics to uncover hidden truths. She had her own YouTube show, all kinds of things. She will be joining us tonight to chat about the Nazca lines in the beginning of our conversation. Welcome, Jean. How are you this evening?
Well, hello, 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 and thank you for having me on. I'm fine as frog's hair split four ways.
Oh, wow. I have not heard that one in a piece.
And how are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be off the road back here at home. Got to go out and play some basketball with my boy today and get to do the show live, which is always fun. Like I've never done a greatest hit show. Even whenever I'm on the road, I've never taken a week off to be sick. Almost 10 years now I've been doing live broadcast of some way, shape or form. So
wow.
It's pretty impressive. And I had someone ask me recently, like, don't you get burned out? And it's like, I don't know. I don't really get burned out having conversations with strangers on trains, you know? So I don't know that I would ever really get the work burns you out. There's a lot of effort that goes into doing show that gets burnouty, but not the conversation, you know? So
yes,
I want to welcome you to the conversation, Jean, before we start digging into the beginning of our topic and where it takes us from there. How did you come to the world of esoteric and forbidden knowledge? How did you come to that being a cause in your life?
I would say it came to me, and I suspect this is true of all intuitives, so-called psychics, whatever label you want to put on people who have understandings that defy mainstream tolerances, if you will.
Sure.
What's allowed, what we're allowed to believe, what we're allowed to experience. A lot of people start questioning authority at a very young age because their personal reality does not jive with what they're being told in their environment by their parents and at school, by their peers, that something's happening to them or they're involved in something that maybe other people aren't experiencing, and it makes them more singular, more select. And when you're a young person in orthodoxy, in an orthodox system, yeah, like school, being different can often be problematic. Different can be bad, different can be good, but and a lot of it depends on how you react to it, but sensitives typically don't react well to pointed attention yeah, of a certain kind, at least, and get singled out and ridiculed. And of course, the government campaign to ridicule people who believed in ESP, anything beyond basically deja vu. Deja vu was okay, right? The sense that you've seen something or been somewhere before, that was okay. That's cool. Ouija boards, kind of borderline. But once you got any deeper into ESP, I do remember seeing spoon benders on television, and I've seen some debunking of that. But I still wonder about the likes of Uri Geller, because I've met Russell Targ, who worked with a lab partner whose name escapes me, back in California at the Stanford Research Institute. Yep. They had grants there, and they had a great time testing for ESP, and their most talented subjects were a police officer, a gentleman, and a housewife. Now, they were their most talented psychics, people we would never have heard about, but they did work for a while with Uri Geller, the more famous television personality, spoonbender. And it was, and there is a YouTube video showing trials they ran with Uri Geller, showing successes and failures.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For various kinds of tests.
Absolutely.
And so in terms of psi or psychic ability, he was good, but there's other people much stronger. Wouldn't you agree?
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I reached back on the shelf. I don't often do that live on show, but I have a little shelf of artifacts and knickknacks, things like that. And one of them is my actual bent spoon that I bent. I bent then. This is not a weak spoon. This is like an actual quality spoon.
With your hands?
Nope. Just like this.
Like stroking it? Like they do?
Just talking.
Kinetically?
Just talking. Not even.
Not stroking it.
Just simply holding it and talking. And it was fascinating.
Did you visualize anything? Did you see it bending in your mind or anything like that?
It was on the remote viewing cruise. And Dr. Angela Thompson Smith was
hold
there
that up
with
again.
Us.
Everybody get a good view of that.
She was actively totally cool. Yeah. Yeah. And I was talking about how, like, the last couple years, they always do a spoon bending thing at the International Remote Viewing Association. They'll always pull a bag of spoons out and people just grab them. They're random spoons. They're all quality spoons. None of them are like dollar store cheap tin spoons. So I pulled this one out and I was like, you know, I've tried and tried. And Angela started just, and she's been on my show before. We're friends. She was my monitor on the cruise. And she was like, you know, for me, it's talking about love and, you know, the idea of just understanding that love is everywhere, that you're a part of it, that it radiates through you. And as she sat there and talked about it, I literally went, oh my gosh. And I mean, I had my fingers, I was just like this and I was like, oh my gosh. She was like, what? I was like, my spoon just bent.
Could you feel it bending?
And I felt it.
When it
get,
did it?
I felt it physically get hot. I felt
that makes
it
sense,
physically
actually.
Get hot.
That's why it
and
would
it
bend.
Bent.
It would slump.
And it was like, whoa. And I mean, I have seen people literally curl this on a spoon.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a
the thick
sardine
part.
Can.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the what? So
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Fascinating.
What the what?
And it's interesting.
Yeah. So it's in front of our very eyes.
Yeah.
And yet the highest powers of the land tell us that we're crazy to think that that's true.
Yeah.
So there's a disconnect going on, a major cultural disconnect going on.
Yeah.
Which is why I think a lot of modernists who have more metaphysical talents and leanings look to ancient archaeology, including the Nazca lines.
Sure.
See what I did there? See the
yeah, yeah. Way to lead into it. It's like you had a
That ancient archaeology becomes more interesting and if not compelling because these were peoples who didn't have the societal filters.
Yeah.
about there's nothing spiritual going on.
Yep.
Basically.
Yeah.
A denial that spiritualism, I'm talking in the nativist terms of consciousness in living organisms that would include plants and perhaps also rocks. The case can be made that rocks have consciousness. I've seen it made. And as a scientist, I can't discard it. I myself can't prove it or disprove it, but intuitively it makes perfect sense to me that everything on the planet would have consciousness, including the planet herself. Gaia has consciousness.
I quite literally host the show with a crystal in my hand regularly, Gene. And I am surrounded by them. I'm a rocks and minerals fiend, rocks and minerals nut.
But it's
one of those specifically, like, there are vibrational ranges that are hit by these things that are just fascinating. When you start looking at the fact of even piezoelectricity, the fact of smacking two quartz crystals together, they will flash. Mm. They'll actively create energy when compressed. You know,
decades ago, I had the great opportunity to go several times to the Coleman clear quartz mines in Arkansas. Cool. And now those mines are much more restricted, just like the Nazca lines.
Yeah.
Another segue. And it's because optical lens makers, the federal government decided that it wanted access to the best quartz in the world, and some of the best quartz in the world in the Coleman mines of Arkansas, to manufacture federal scientific apparatus that would include things as large as telescope lenses and things as small as microscope lenses and even smaller.
Yeah.
So I understand. I've looked into it lately, but I'm glad I had the opportunity to dig quartz out.
That's
quartz
awesome.
Points.
Yeah.
Quartz points. Out of the tailing piles. That's where tourists were allowed to go. You could dig all, you could camp there. We camped and we dug and we rigged our own muriatic acid bath to get the rust off the point. And then we made jewelry with them. And it was the coolest thing.
Awesome.
It was a once in a lifetime opportunity, as we now know, because everything changes. But that quartz is so pure. You talk about resonance and purity. Well, vibration.
Yeah.
All of these things relate. The federal government finally got hip to it. And I think it was partly due to some of these DARPA projects that would include Targ's ESP projects and remote viewing under Ed Dames, if he's to be believed at all. He did a lot of fear mongering and then he disappeared to Ukraine, apparently, with his wife. And he did that doomsday prophecy, doomsday event.
Yeah.
Extinction event.
Yeah.
That all the remote viewers could not see past a certain date. And their last vision was a battlefield scene where the soldiers on both sides stopped fighting, looked up, and then laid down their arms and left in opposite directions, going home, presumably.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
we all believed that. He said it was going to be 2014, I think, that happened. And then it was 2015, and then he sort of disappeared.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've done numerous shows on prophecy, things like that. And the fact of, like, no, you can't give a hard date to things like that.
And he did give signs and indicators of that, too. There were three signs. And one of them was above ground nuclear tests in Korea. And the last one was an aircraft that resembled a space shuttle in terms of how it looks.
Yeah.
Being struck down by starry objects in the sky, explosive starry objects being forced to land. And that has not happened to my knowledge. So I guess we're in the clear.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't heard of the X-37 space plane being in danger at any point.
In a meteor shower or forced down from asteroids or something like that,
any
of a number of things might happen to account for fiery star-like explosions that would alter the course of a space-going vehicle.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly.
What was curious was the claim that, for me as a psychic, none of the remote viewers could see beyond a certain event.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely.
If that is true.
And there's
now, I'm
the
a skeptic. I am a psychic, and I know what I know, but I don't know what anybody else knows. I want to be open-minded and tolerant, but I'm also skeptical, meaning that if I wasn't there, I really don't know.
Yeah.
To the greatest extent.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And you know, that is an important part scientifically to bring up, is the fact of without that, it's hearsay. Without your actual physical presence, things like that. And sadly, that is what we get to deal with a lot with ancient history. Sadly, history is written by the victors most of the time. We find things from older civilizations that were conquered, stuff like that. But most of the time it was pillaged. It was gone. The society was absorbed into the conquering society, things like that. And when it comes to the Nazca lines, things like that, like my first introduction to them was actually Time Life Books.
Oh, yeah.
That is where I first heard about the mystic places, the whole chapter about it. And I remember I did a report in high school about the Nazca lines and their possible connections to aliens, all kinds of things.
Oh, you did? That was pretty brazen.
I was very surprised that my teacher allowed it. I think much like my mom, she was just happy I was reading a book, not just building circuits or taking things apart.
I had a similar experience in college where I had a really tough paleontology class. And the final, and I attended all the lectures. I'd done all the work. I was prepared, I thought, for the final. The only question that really was tripping me up was compare and contrast, I think it was 4 theories of human evolution. And 3 of them sprang right to mind. But I was struggling for the 4th. You know, I'm in a physical classroom, sweating bullets, taking this final exam. And I thought, well, you know, even in college, I'd been researching UFOs since I was about 16. So I was 6 years into it already. I'm already basically a subject matter expert. And at this college, I was able to get, lay hands on and eyes on and read books like the Bhagavad Gita source book, material.
Yep.
And I got to see Indian texts that showed the pictures of the Vimanas, the flying ships, flying cities, call them flying cities. So Vimanas. And I looked at this cross section of a Vimana from this ancient Indian Vedic text. And certainly not the oldest writing on earth, but amongst, you know, we're getting back there now. We're getting back into antiquity. And I looked at this cross section, a line drawing of cross section of a Vimana. And there was some anthropological interpretation about what we were looking at. And without even reading the interpretation, I just looked at the drawing and I went, that's an engineering schematic.
Mm.
That's clearly an engineering schematic. And I looked at the interpretation in the book and they were way off. It's always a stylized flower or something like that in these books. So I just filed that away for future reference, but it's interesting in later years. It was interesting later years to see people refer to these texts and having held it in my own hand. It was really one of the most exciting points of my life because these texts are kept away from the public. I would love to. Wouldn't you love to scour the Vatican Library?
Oh, God. There's almost 50 miles.
Have a library card books. To the Vatican Library? Yes.
And you know, like I can speak to just what my college had, because I worked in facilities and got to move a few things that got moved from like the library vault to like display at certain parties, like, you know, medieval tapestries, things like that.
Could you put those pictures back up of the Vimanas there? Yeah. So if you scroll down there a little bit, I think you actually have one of them that. So those lower two, the one on the left, that one there, especially that, what, Sundara Vimana? Uh-huh. That I think is the actual picture that I was looking at. And I don't even remember how they explained it, but it was wrong. I thought this is a UFO. Actually, I'm not sure I had connected that dot quite then, but I knew it wasn't what they thought it was or said it was. And in those days, college textbook. This was not a college textbook. In those days, textbooks, though, that did interpret, that say would cite that book, the original source book, they're citing that book and reproducing images from that book and saying, and there, and we think this and that and the other about it, similar to how the Nazca lines are interpreted or crop circles are interpreted or anything is interpreted. And the mainstream goes along with the mainstream, and until something heretical comes along, then they disrespect that for a while. And then either the heretical idea is accepted as the new mainstream or tossed out as utterly whack. You know, just no way that could be a thing.
Yep.
But when I first saw a picture in a book, a source book of Egyptian tomb art and sculpture and paintings, I saw that a tableau that's now relatively well known. It's a very large human figure holding an object with both hands. And this object rests upon the back of a presumed slave who appears to be much smaller. And then there's other smaller humans who are thought to be slaves. And the tall person would be a god, okay, if you go with this paradigm. The tall person holding this object has a bunch of minions with them. And this thing is basically a fluorescent light with a filament in it and a cord coming out the end. But it, like anything Egyptian, it's made to look like a flower or a blossom. Yeah. It's artistic as well as scientific. And it was a big old light bulb, probably used in pyramid construction and things like that. They did a lot of tomb work.
Yeah, you know, the Dendera bulb.
Because it's so bloody hot in the desert, you want to get in the shade. I think that's a one principal reason why temples were built all around the world. A roof, you build a roof. You don't need walls necessarily. But let's get a roof so that the elite, the priests and the priestesses who serve the gods, I have a whole discourse on that relationship. Let's get them out of the hot sun because we like them better. And let's give them some privilege and some preference, and everybody else can be out in the hot sun toiling.
Yeah.
There it is. Yeah. So those are clearly filaments. It's clearly a light bulb. There's just no mistaking it. And I'm not kidding. The interpretation by the anthropologist who had edited this book in the 1970s was that that was a stylized flower. Mm-hmm. And I went.
Yeah. A stylized lotus.
Stylized flower.
Yeah.
Stylus looks. I went, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So well, that began my career of questioning authority and going into the fringe full speed ahead, getting as much source data as I can. And so I really admire the likes of Linda Moulton Howe, who started as reporter in Denver, Colorado, and just chanced upon cattle mutilations as she was contacted by ranchers to go out and take a look at this strange thing, this strange phenomenon that they could not report. Well, they couldn't claim it for insurance, really. That was the big deal with the ranchers. So money is behind a lot of stuff that goes on in metaphysics, believe it or not.
Oh, sure.
A lot of people like to ignore that. Oh, green energy money, green energy bad, you know, peace and love good. And, you know, peace and love are good, but in a materialistic world, you need material, and in a materialistic society like ours, it helps to have that green energy or something that you can trade for it, right? I mean, ultimately, you have a talent or a skill or a quality that people perceive as valuable, and you can trade that off for this token economy we have going here.
Yeah.
But cattle mutilations are, in fact, animal mutilations is how I title it. It's one of the chapters in my book, because I believe that how and other people starting to investigate that particular topic at the same time, so late 1970s, early 1980s, this was a real challenge to mainstream belief, a real challenge to that authority that the CIA was in charge of maintaining, that someone as credible as Howe would be hard to discredit or deny or create disbelief. But they did it. They still waged campaign against her, media campaign against
absolutely.
Her, you know.
Absolutely. And you know, it's fascinating because once again, the Nazca lines, to bring this back to that, have been the source.
We could actually
of,
talk about that if you want.
Have been the source of a lot of controversy over the years.
Even
the fact of there was the hypothesis put out there of them being built using hot air balloons as observation platforms. And there was a piece of pottery that was
except
found
there were no hot air balloons.
Yeah,
at the time.
Well,
of,
I mean, the Montgolfiers
year one
were
the
first
Gregorian
ones.
Calendar.
There, as we know it, the hot air balloon began with the Montgolfiers. But who
and
knows?
And when were they?
That was 1800, 1700, something like that.
So not one, not year one.
No, absolutely not. but once again, the piece of pottery
the Nazca lines
that
date,
seems
for
to
people
show,
who don't know, I'm sorry,
yo,
the
no,
Nazca
go
lines
ahead.
Date from, for people, listeners who aren't familiar, and I had to look it up myself. The Nazca civilization, to whom these lines are attributed, for correct or not, were active from about 100 after year one Gregorian, from about 100 to about 700 or 800. So they overlap the Mayans, which I think is interesting.
Yep.
But the Nazca civilization grew on top of another civilization. And you know the name. It slips right off your tongue. And I just learned it.
The Paracas.
Paracas. Correct. Yeah. So the Paracas left some textile art. They had a very distinct artistic sensibility, which is very interesting, and to see, and so they did lines also, but the lines that they did were on hillsides, on slopes, where you could actually see them, and they did relief geoglyphs is what these are called, geoglyphs, geo for earth, glyphs for symbols. So they did earth symbols where they heaped up stone or dirt to create shadowing, basically, so relief art. Relief and bas-relief for the artists out there. So relief means built up, raised is actually what it comes from in Latin, raised. But the Aztec lines, which started after the other civilization was gone or on the way out, are a different technology and a much different scope and very different art and art. Artistic depictions of animals and humans. Well, humans are animals. Artistic depictions of mostly humans. I'm sorry, mostly humans, yes, and animals. In fact, I mean, what else would they depict? But they didn't do mountains. They didn't do sunrise as much. They did objects like animals.
Yeah.
But they also did geometric lines and shapes. And some of these are kilometers, miles, miles and miles and miles long. I mean, just the scope of this project is insane in terms of its size and the sophistication of the art. It may not look very sophisticated, but two things. One, the technology is, instead of heaping up, doing a raised relief, these people are scooping out or something scooped out. Yeah. So they scooped an inch or so of pebbles on top of this plateau that are littered everywhere to reveal the soil underneath, which is sort of this reddish clay color that we're seeing here on your screen there. So this is not a complicated technology, but it becomes formidable when you think about the tools these folks had at their discretion. And again, no record of why they did this or how they did this or actually who did it. We know it happened. Well, we associate the lines with the Nazca. I don't know if you can date these or not, if it's possible to date these. I don't know, and I haven't looked into it. But my point is that these lines – I chanced upon Nazca lines first from Eric von Doniggen, who wrote Chariots of the Gods. And the precept of that book is things like Nazca lines and crop circles are only visible from altitude. You mentioned hot air balloons.
Yep.
Those came in early 1800s, right? You just said. And then Nazca lines got into popular Western consciousness in the 1920s. When airplanes started roving around. And so between hot air balloons and airplanes, the Nazca lines were identified by Westerners. I'm sure that the natives knew they were there all along. But it's not at all clear that the natives knew what these lines represented, because if you've never been up in the air over them, how could you? It's like standing in the middle of a crop circle. You can't tell what the image is inside the crop circle. You can tell that something's happened. You can see trampled crops, but you cannot perceive the overall image until you gain some altitude. Now, in crop circle country, which is southern England for the most part, around Avebury and Stonehenge, specifically, Wiltshire County is a big hot spot. There are hills there. There are natural features that will let you climb up to an altitude and look. So, but not every crop circle is formed in a place that has some place where you could look at it. Okay. So there's a bit of a bugaboo. The problem with Nazca, the scientific problem with Nazca, is that we have these geometric arrays that are tallest skyscrapers, if you measured them out, longest football fields. The comparisons made are just staggering. If you've ever dug anything in the dirt, like if you've worked, I garden, okay? Yep. So I dig holes and I plant things and I move rocks and I deal with pavers, which are stone slabs, basically. And I've done it my whole life. So when I was young and strong, I would think nothing of picking up boulders and flinging them around or doing this or that or the other. But the anthropologists would have us believe that these so-called primitive people who had stone implements, maybe some bronze, were scraping kilometers, square acres of geometric designs that are very precise from the air. I did read recently that some anthropologists are putting forward the notion that these were walkways, ceremonial walkways. So, for example, the monkey with the spiraling tail might be a shamanic pathway. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm thinking that something else, something – and let's just be honest. I research UFOs. E.T. oversaw the construction, if didn't actually construct these lines. Now, why would they do that? Why the Nazca lines? Let's go back to mainstream anthropology. Why the Nazca lines? To invoke rain, because it's very arid there, very little rainfall. And the case is made that spiders symbolize rain and monkeys symbolize rainforests. And there's a scorpion. There's various animals that relate to rain and water. Okay, fine. Great. However, there's a whole bunch of images of llamas as well. Are they associated with rain? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that E.T. got there first and they shaved off the mountaintop. And I suspect that that some of these glyphs are distress signals. I think that some E.T. got stranded on Earth. Some technology broke down on them, or something went horribly wrong, and they needed some rescue ahead of time. Now, I have only my extensive studies in metaphysics and my intuition to guide me in this, but my higher self says I'm on the right track. You can make of that what you will. I don't demand that anyone believe what I believe by any means. I explain truths as I see them, and I want to allow possibilities where other people might say it's impossible. I'm saying, what if, like History Channel, is it possible that ancient aliens got marooned on Earth and, like in Castaway, where the character played by Tom Hanks is drawing SOS on the sand, dumb, because it gets washed away. But, you know, when you're trapped in a place, when you're trapped in the wilderness, when you're trapped on a desert island, you want a single SOS, either with rocks or carvings or a fire, you know, something like that. So because these glyphs, geoglyphs from the Nazca, fall into two broad categories, geometrics and then artistic representation, right, of animals and people, I put it to you, the lines are basically navigational to direct spacecraft, like runways.
Sure.
And some of these line up with solar alignments like solstices.
Yep.
But I think that I think the pictorial art may be akin to graffiti. Mm. And some of it may also represent, hey, there's goodies here. They got this rich stuff going on here. And, you know, rich biome.
Mm. Sure.
Excuse me.
Yeah. And even the picture that we had up on screen here of the monkey glyph, you know, when you look at that, you can see all kinds of other markings around it, almost overlaid on top of it. So it's not like it stands on its own. There are other markings there along with it. There are lines that lead even here. With the hummingbird, you can see other lines that lead to other things along inside of them. So, yeah.
If you go scroll back up to that hummingbird one, one point made in an article I just read was that a lot of these, this category of glyph is constructed of one single line.
Yes.
A looping line. That's very sophisticated art, it seems to me. Now, I'm not an artist, but I'm not an artist, but I've studied a lot of crop circles, a lot more crop circles than Nazca lines. And the geometry behind crop circles is nothing short of amazing.
Yeah.
And you look at Foster Gamble, the son of Mr. Gamble of Procter and Gamble. The son of Gamble, the senior, the elder. Foster went his own way. He didn't want to get into exploiting earthly materials. So he got into esoteric research, started the Thrive movement, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Yep.
And anyone out there in the audience, if you haven't heard of Thrive, I encourage you to go check out the Thrive movie. It'll change your life for the better, I hope. And Foster teamed up with engineers who took crop circles as two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional objects.
Yeah.
So if you take a flat crop circle and project it as a sphere, all of a sudden you've got toroidal. A toroid is a donut shape.
Yep.
You've got toroidal fields, and there's a toroidal field around the Earth. A lot of planets have toroidal fields. Toroids are a big thing in physics and metaphysics. And it blew my mind to see that this two-dimensional crop circle, when expanded, you know, in digital graphics, right, DG, expanded into a moving machine, if you will, a moving energy pattern is really what it would be, moving energy pattern, that some of these patterns suggest, well, actually, engineers built to these specs. Some of the Thrive engineers built machinery based on these patterns in 3D. And they discovered that these objects do stuff. They actually create energy fields that do things. And so who's creating crop circles? Who created Nazca lines? Who created crop circles? Because crop circles are a current day phenomenon. They're ongoing.
Well, and they go
back. They didn't go away with the civilization.
They also go back to medieval times. There were notations of crop circles in circulars and stories, things like that. Devil circles, they called them. And that's something that I always bring up. Like, much like the Nazca lines, it had to have been something of great importance for the people that did build the man-made Nazca lines, at least, because literally you're in the midst of living and surviving. That's why you know that the crop circles that were devil circles in the medieval times weren't fake. Good Lord, last thing you do is go sheave down half a field of wheat that could keep a village alive just to make everybody go, hey, look over there, and then suddenly think the devil did it, you know? You're lucky the people didn't think the devil was in your house and burned the place to the ground to begin with when they saw the crop circle, you know? So, yes, I'm not denying the fact that there are man-made crop circles, folks. There was a whole group of hoaxers for a long time, things like that. But when you start getting into some of the crop circles and especially blown nodes, things like that, some of the science behind crop circles, some of the strange energy fields that have been detected around true and genuine crop circles, that is a totally different story, man. And there is something to it.
I agree entirely. And the question arises, for whom were the Nazca lines constructed? For whom are crop circles constructed? For us humans or for them, whoever they are?
Sure.
You know, extraterrestrials, interdimensionals, us from the future, you know, future us. There's all kinds of theories about, well, all kinds of theories behind UFOs. And are crop circles related to UFOs? For a long time,
possibly.
I was persuaded that, yes, there could well be a connection there. However, Patty Greer, one of my most respected crop circle researchers, came out probably 10 years ago now, at least, that based on her extensive research and with the original scientist's assistant, Levin Good, I think was his name, and his assistant's name is Penny. So he died. He was doing research on crop circles in the 1950s, and he found out that anything that grows within the crop circle creates super seeds, packed with nutrients, and grow big, grow lush, grow fast. So Patty Greer piggybacked off of his Levin Good's ideas.
Yeah.
With Penny's help, and they have concluded that crop circles are not smushed down. They are lifted out from the earth, that Gaia is extruding these somehow. And that's a real mind blower. I haven't seen all the research behind that, but she's a credible researcher, and she knows more about the topic than just about anybody on earth, I would imagine. She's a real devotee of the subject. And I have to wonder, are crop circles for us, or are they actually for them as signposts, indicators, or some of each, you know, some of each that, we're going to leave ourselves some instructions that are visible from the air. In other words, what do you do when you're traveling to some unknown country and you've flown into the airport, maybe gotten to the train station? One of the first things you might well do is look at a map.
No different than a Boy Scout tagging a tree.
Where am I and where am I going?
Yeah.
Map. So who's to say that crop circles aren't signposts, map markings? We know they occur on ley lines. They occur on sacred spots. What up, what up, what up? Research is hampered because of mainstream science's reluctance and inability, quite honestly, to admit to the possibility of psychic or otherworldly phenomenon at play. And it's a real limitation as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
However, it does keep us employed. It keeps us occupied. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you know, it's one of those, there's a lot of people who are very upset. I was just looking for my phenomenology book. It's back there on the other shelf. There's a lot of people that are very upset with the relabeling of things in the UFO community, Gene, to UAP.
Oh, I know.
And
I've talked about this whole obfuscation of UFOs by calling them UAPs, but please continue.
I am a fan of it for one reason, because it lands it directly in the backyard of science. This is an actual scientific reference book printed in 1975, Strange Phenomena. That's literally for scientists to be able to reference. There are articles in here going back to like fireballs in the sky in the 1600s, things like that, reprints of old articles, all kinds of stuff. But the idea is phenomena, because you have to be able to remove the phenomena from your data set. Period. That's science. So you have to be able to account for the phenomena in your data set and in your experiment. So when you call it an aerial phenomena, that means science cannot ignore it anymore simply because it's called the term that they don't like.
I wonder if also, I don't disagree. I think those are very valid points. I wonder, too.
It kind of drags them in kicking and screaming.
The problem, one problem with object is that if, based on my research, and I believe this is true, the United States and other governments, but specifically the United States, got its hands, United States government, got its hands on downed UFOs, Feldcraft, and began reverse engineering them. And discovered very early on that you could replicate the hardware of the craft, but there was another component to these crafts, and that was simply put consciousness.
Yeah.
The pilots wore suits and had circuitry or something going on inside the craft where their consciousness was collaborative with the hardware to make these things fly. I saw an interesting video on YouTube a long time ago. I don't know if I could find it again now, but a man who claimed he was a test flight Air Force guy, test pilot for the Air Force, had been tasked with taking up a UFO in front of cameras. It was a test demo. And they said, just think the instructions and the craft will do what you want it to do. Mm-hmm. So he got in and he went up and they said he had instructions. You go up to a certain altitude, some hundreds of feet. You're going to hover for a while and then you're going to come back down. You're going to hover for a while. We're going to take some pictures and then that'll be the end of the test. So he gets up there. He's hovering around and ground control says, okay, now land. And he thinks just for the briefest instant, oh gosh, we didn't cover landing. How do I land this thing? And he crashed to the ground.
Yeah.
And became disabled, broke his legs. Poor guy.
Well,
the government understood very early on that these weren't merely objects. Okay.
Oh, sure.
So to rename them as unidentified aerial phenomena speaks to the experiencer reality, the reality of people who have experienced UFOs, either by observing them from far away or up close and personal, laying hands on like at Rendlesham Forest.
Well, and even the fact of, once again, that not all of them are necessarily material craft. One of the things that we show regularly on the show, I'm bringing it up right now, we have a whole knowledge vault on our website full of declassified government materials, all kinds of things. And one of the things that we show, which happened to come about right at the same time as all of the GoFast videos and everything else, is the F-18 laser pod countermeasures. This is an actual patent for an existing product that fits onto an F-18. And notice, all of the videos that we've seen from Aero come from an F-18 forward-looking gun pod. This is a laser hologram that is a form of laser chaff that projects another craft the same size as a jet or larger to any temperature that they want to basically intercept heat-seeking missiles. So this object also appears on radar. It appears on passive radar. And it's pretty interesting. That's a thing that exists. That is a plasmoid hologram. That is a projection of laser light making a plasma hologram. So, yeah, doesn't even have to be a physical craft. Could be something like that. But that is still something that is, once again, over our skies and has to be accounted for. So, yeah.
But, you know, when these new organizations started around 2020, to look into the now UAP phenomenon, they went to square one.
Oh yeah.
They said we have no prior knowledge, no prior reports, no prior literature, no prior resources. We're starting right. I was covering this at the time because I was so bemused by this posturing on the part of the U.S. government. After all the decades of lying about the existence of UFOs, now they're saying, yeah, there's really something to it. And that was, I think, to give credit because of the enormous psychological toll having to keep these secrets were for the military personnel. I think it was really affecting morale and their psychological profiles when you have to keep this secret or people start dying and you lose your job.
Well, the problem,
and bad things happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very stressful. I think the Navy had to do it and they chose their time. However, they have not admitted to the existence of ET. They say, yeah, the craft are real.
Sure.
In other words, the pilots are, they're kind of doing what the anthropologists are doing to Nazca lines. They're saying, yeah, okay, well, the pilots are actually seeing something. The lines are actually there. But we can't speak for what is operating these things or where they came from, what engineered them. And that's basically hokum. That's a lie. It's a big, fat lie. The government knows a lot more than it's letting on to. But it was very convenient for them to reorganize and say, we're going to give it a new name. Now it's a phenomenon. It's not an object. We have new task force. We have new bureaucracy.
Well, because all of that.
We're going to start with case one.
All of that releases actual money, not black money.
Already this year, you know, the first year, already this year, the first 3 months of this year, we have 215 cases. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Just forehead slap. You have got to be yanking my chain. After decades of UFO research, now you're telling me that you have 200 cases?
Two 200 cases that boiled down to 5 videos and 5 things that were actual phenomena that they couldn't figure out. One of them that was eviscerated by NASA once it was actually taken to task. And it's interesting to see some of the things once again that are on video, but it's how you bring things like this into the light. And it's literally the only legal way to bring things like this into the light. Because like we said on the show before, if they have reverse engineered technology, then they have spent billions of dollars in private research. And the only way that you get that back is to either weaponize it or put it on a shelf.
Probably trillions now. It started in the millions. I've done research on expense, the kind of expense that black ops projects get where it's not, these are not accountable to the public, which doesn't mean there's no accounting going on anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Just means that we, the taxpayers funding these projects, never see any accountability, no budget items of what's going on. It was millions back in the 60s and 70s and then billions in the 80s and 90s and turn of the century. Now it's trillions, I think. And it helps explain the impoverishment of the United States. Hmm. When I was a youth, we were a flush nation. We were prosperous. And we are not as prosperous now. My standard of living now, it's not apples to apples because we have so much more technology than we did when I was a child. But in terms of perceived comfort, I think, perceived standard of living, the idea that only one parent had to work and you could get by with one car and mom stayed home. Typically, mom stayed home with the kids and it was much more agrarian country, more farms, cities, yes, but smaller. And then everything began to change and
farms went
on the way out and cities were on the rise.
That's also the change of a culture and a society to begin with, especially once technology comes about, you know. That's just about any agrarian society that becomes technological. That is the story.
But this happens so fast.
But it does happen
fast. Very fast.
That's just it. Like I said, Gene, before the show, as a Cajun, the point that I bring up regularly, one generation, it's all it took for an entire culture of people to forget a language indigenous to America. One generation, it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long for us to forget how to hand carve a spiral wooden column and just let a machine CNC it out. It gets done in one day with the machine. You want it done in one day or you want it done in 12 days by hand? You know? So it doesn't take long for us to rapidly forget those things as humanity because of the ease with which technology gives our life. When you start looking at cultures like the Inca, the Nazca, even Native American cultures, things like that, most ancient cultures lived and died by the stars, by the sun, by the moon. That is what told you, if you weren't a settled culture, it's what told you when to move your society with whatever food was available. It's what told you when to put plant in the ground, when to take it out of the ground. You lived and died by the stars. Once we got technology, we didn't have to know when Orion rose to get food anymore. We could kill bison by the thousands in a day with a rifle instead of a bow and arrow, you know? So the industrialization of man brings about a lot of the forgetting of that stuff and a lot of the putting that by the wayside, which is why, you know, it's one of those many cultures, especially back then, did not write things down. It was passed down through the elders. It was passed down. Things were even the idea nowadays of an apprenticeship, the idea that like that was once guarded knowledge, an apprenticeship. You got into a society of people that were builders, plumbers, what have you, and that knowledge was passed down to you. You didn't pick up a book and learn it. That's where the whole concept societally of like it takes 10,000 hours to become a professional. That's basically doing something 30 hours a week for 5 years. That's what 10,000 hours comes out to. So when you look at moving from like an apprentice electrician to a master electrician, that's the time gap, you know. It takes time, but if you don't have people passing that information down anymore, it gets lost rapidly.
Yes, but it's very curious that the United States government, for example, seemingly will not take advantage of the legions of citizen scientists.
Oh, sure.
Who've taken various esoteric topics for study amongst themselves. There's a lot more subtext going on than we will ever know. You know, we the people will never know for sure. But at least the Pentagon did come out and say that UFOs, UAPs are an actual phenomenon and you're not crazy. You're not crazy if you think you've seen one. That's a nice, refreshing spring breeze.
Yeah, and we have technologies like the ability to telepathically control a drone. We have all this stuff. It exists. Follow Defense One, folks. If you don't follow that, follow Jane's Defense Weekly on your RSS reader. You will be privy to all kinds of really, really cool programs like that that come out. We've been able to control a drone, a soldier. We have had a helmet that a soldier can control 5 drones independently for the last decade. They are not using their hands whatsoever. It is a helmet that literally you can put on and thought control a drone. That's been going on for a decade at a minimum. It's fascinating the things that are out there, the high technology that's out there. And, you know, once again, the idea that these things are occulted, literally the meaning of occulted just means hidden from the light, you know.
Yes. Secret societies. Occult knowledge, all kinds,
and the occult secret knowledge handshakes, doesn't stop.
Secret hand signs, you know.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't stop with technology. Is the thing? It just becomes a different realm of occulted knowledge. No different than you may know how to use a website. Do you know how to program a website? You know, that is or occulted like, knowledge.
We used to say you may know a lot of people know how to drive a car, but could you build a car or even fix your car?
What's funny, there are countries like Italy, UK, there used to be like a half engine model that was like halfway sliced in half. I saw one in a guy's garage when I lived in Italy, and I was like, what's that about? And literally for the longest time, you could not get your driver's license in Italy without being able to get an engine like that running. Like, you had to be able to explain what every part in that moving engine was and what it did in order to be able to get your driver's license. You had to actively know how to like basic maintenance, how to change oil, how to change a battery, how to diagnose a problem, things like that. It was like, wow. Not the case here. I don't even think you have to parallel park in most states anymore.
So, of course, cars are now designed with so much computerized stuff that It's hard to work. They are designed so that you won't work on them. A lot of cars have cowling, plastic cowlings over the places where the parts are.
Yeah.
So you can't, I mean, it's a whole step just to get the cowling off, to get to the business end of it all. You know?
I worked in shops for a while, and my family dealt in tires, all kinds of things. And the idea of book hours, the idea of like, well, no, it may take you 45 minutes, but it's 3 hours on the book. Because you may run into problems. You might not be able to get that cowling off. You may have to contact NAPA and get a special key to get it off. I need this special tool bit to be able to get this off of a certain vehicle. Like it's crazy sauce.
I just learned what a chainsaw tool is. I read the manual. I found a chainsaw in my garage that my mom left behind, and Craftsman Electric. I'm leafing through this thing, and it shows a picture of it's like a key.
Yeah.
One side has a wrench for the blade to loosen the blade. Yep. So you can change the chain. And then the other end is a screwdriver.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Wild stuff.
But I've seen these things all my life and I was like, in tool.
That's a weird looking tool.
I'm a tool user. I'm a toolie.
Well,
so I've seen these things all my life. There was one in the house here that my mom left behind. I'm like, what does this go to? It looks important. I'll keep it.
That's one of the examples I give on the show regularly is would we even recognize the technology, Gene? If I took it, I've got a thumb drive right here, 1 gigabyte, all kinds of stuff. If I took it and threw it over my shoulder, and then the sands of time bury it for 1,000 years and people find it. How do they even know what that thing is? Or how to access it? No different than a crystal.
Exactly.
We're using crystals and quartz to store information. Mm. So who's to say that previous civilizations didn't figure that out as well? Even if it's storing a vibration or memory in a crystal.
It's funny you say that. I was just thinking of burying something for future generations to dig up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Make sure the realtors find it first.
Just to make them scratch their
heads. Gene, I want to thank you so much for your time tonight. It literally flew by.
I know.
It was absolutely fun. We've got to have you back on.
Thanks.
Your book, Unknown Objects, The Top 10 U.S. UFO Cases, is available on Amazon. Where else can people go to find all your work? Where else can they go to watch your show that you had, all kinds of stuff?
Well, if you head over to YouTube and look for Taboo Topics and my last name, Broida, B-R-O-I-D-A, you will find my somewhat short-lived show. It was a lot of fun. I had some great guests, but I want to warn anybody heading over there that we had major technology issues, which was the main reason why I stopped doing the show. I could not resolve these technology issues because I was working full time at the same time. So much as I enjoy hosting shows, it became, I'm a perfectionist and I wasn't happy with the technical quality.
Yeah.
The technical quality.
Yeah.
But you can head over to YouTube I have a channel there. Nothing recent. However, that may change soon.
Okay.
The book on Amazon, which you mentioned, what was I going to say? Oh, if you want to email me, I'm a humble person. You can just email me, GeneBroida@yahoo.com. I had my domain lightwork111.com, but it was confusing people. Apparently they didn't get it.
So. Wow.
I've stopped that.
Okay. Well, Gene, thank you so
much.
But
I used to go by Lightworker 111 because of the synchronicity.
Absolutely. Well, that's
thanks
all
for
right.
Having
that's
me.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll definitely have you on again. I'll be reaching out with links to the episode once it finishes tonight and posts out and everything else. So take
care
of yourself.
I've really enjoyed my time with you, Chris. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely.
And good night, everybody.
Good night. Take care, Gene. Wow. Awesome conversation with Gene Broida there, folks. Once again, the idea of occulted technologies, the idea of occulted concepts and topics, it's always been the fact of nothing is kind of like the Kamertash concept with Curious Realm. Nothing is forbidden in Curious Realm, but certain practices are forbidden, but no knowledge is forbidden. The idea is to go out, to look, to search, to find. So make sure that you go out and look up and search and find and get your copy of Unknown Objects, the top 10 U.S. UFO cases from our guest, Gene Broida. While you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That's where you can find not only the Knowledge Vault, but also our store, which is full of not only videos and music, but also books from all of our guests as well, as our copy, or your copy. You can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by friend and guest Greg Lawson. He is a former Travis County Sheriff's Department sheriff. We will be talking with him about the Rainy Street murders here in Austin right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Tonight, I am very proud to welcome Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective. He is one of the hosts on Paranormal 60 on Wednesday nights and also one of the hosts of the new show, Three Gorillas Podcast. And their first episode was actively about a topic that we have covered a couple times here, the Rainy Street murders right here in Austin. And you have a very special perspective on this, Greg, because you were actively a retired Travis County sheriff who was in charge of training sheriffs and things like training detectives, that kind of stuff. So you have a very, very unique insight on this ongoing case here in Travis County. How did this case first come across y'all's desk? How did you get involved with being a Travis County sheriff to begin with? And how did this case come to you guys?
Yeah, as far as me being a cop, that was never in the books. That was never in the stars. It's really funny. I went to my 20-year high school reunion, and we're doing all our stuff, and then all of a sudden they're like, "All right, if everybody gather around, we have some awards for people," and they start giving out awards, and they're the most successful person or the most educated, but sure, whatever it was. And I'm standing there and they're like, "Greg Lawson, come on, step up." I'm like, "What?
What did I do?"
Yeah. And I got an award for the most changed because I came a cop.
The guy who went from running from the cops on a Friday night is now a cop.
Actually, that is exactly right. I had long hair and smoked cigarettes and had a motorcycle and had a Vespa scooter for a while, which is really funny because people would make fun of me riding my little scooter around. But yeah, that being a cop was never in the stars for me. And it was kind of I don't know what happened, but I ended up in the Army.
Okay.
So I graduated in 80, 82 and the economy had crashed in 81, there was no jobs out there at all if you had no skill set. And me, straight out of high school, my skill set was listening to loud rock and roll, riding motorcycles and doing goofy stuff. And so I couldn't find a job. And I went to a temporary agency, and the old man there said, "Son, you know, you have no education, you have no experience, you have no skill set, you need to go in the military." And I'm like, "Screw you, old man."
Yeah.
3 weeks later, I'm on the bus, man. Heading into the Army. So I go in the Army. I had a really good time in the Army. I got to travel all over the place. I was with the Rapid Deployment Unit from the 82nd Airborne Division. So,
oh, wow.
I was in Central America. I was in Middle East. I was in North Africa. I was up in Alaska. And so I had a really good time. And when I got out, I went back to what I wanted to do. And I go back to Austin, go to the University of Texas, and I'm in the fine arts program. I was supposed to be an artist.
Okay.
And money was still really tight, even though I had the GI Bill. And my sister said, "Hey, you should go to work for the sheriff's office." I'm like, "Screw that. I'm going to be a cop. Are you kidding me?"
And I already went and worked for the man. You want me to go work for that man?
The pay was garbage. Some good benefits out of it. She goes, "You should just go ride out with these guys." So I went out and rode out with a guy named Rick Pitino.
Okay.
And in that 10 hours, we had so much fun. I had no idea how much fun you could have, you know, stopping the bullies from doing stuff. So I thought, you know what? That's what I'm going to do.
Awesome. And
so that kind of got me into that. As far as, you know, I'm using the air quotes, Rainy Street Ripper goes.
Yeah.
So I worked patrol. I worked what's called mental health. It's a crisis intervention team. You're a hostage negotiator, a suicide mediator, and you serve mental health warrants on folks that need, you know, some diversion from their criminal behavior into, let's say, the state hospital or other hospitals. And then I worked as a team member and in several different jobs.
Wow.
In SWAT. I was a academy instructor. Then I promoted to detective. I worked homicide. I worked major crimes, you know, as far as child abuse and sex crimes, that sort of stuff. And then I ended up promoting. And during that whole time, I worked lake patrol, and I was on the underwater recovery team for about 18 years. And so, you know, with the Rainy Street, I use it again, the Rainy Street Ripper.
Yeah.
Idea is I sat back and looked at this, and it's like all of those bodies that we're talking about as far as someone possibly being involved in putting these bodies in the water.
Mm.
Obviously, you know, that came up with my expertise. Currently, I am the only person that I know of, I could be wrong, but I am the only person in the state of Texas that travels around to different agencies and actually teaches aquatic death investigation.
Oh, wow.
Nobody does it.
Wow. No. Greg, I did not realize that.
Yeah, it's really bizarre, because I always say, man, if you want to get away with murder, dump the body in the water. The cops aren't ever going to figure it out.
It destroys almost all evidence. Almost all evidence.
You have to be really dumb for us to catch you if you've dumped somebody in the water.
You know, the prime example of that, I just watched the Pitino documentary. And that was a case where it's like literally the guy told him where he went out in his boat. Like, "I went out to this island," and like they tracked the path of the body and from there. Yep. And it's like, yep, that's where it came from. Like, had he never told them that he went out in his boat, that he went out to that area, everything, the chances of them connecting those two things would have been nil.
Yeah, zero. And so, because how most drownings happen, they're either an attended drowning or they're an unattended drowning. So an attended drowning, that's the ones that we normally deal with in Lake Travis as part of the Travis County Underwater Recovery Team and Lake Patrol is people are having fun. Somebody jumps in the water. Somebody looks away. They look back. It's like, where's Bill?
Yeah.
Where'd he go? But we have a last point scene. He jumped in the water, right?
So absolutely.
That's typically an accident. The problem with a rainy street with the Lady Bird Lake drownings or the Rainy Street Ripper victims, these are all unattended deaths. So yeah. This person walks out of a bar. Last time we see him is on video walking out of the bar or walking down Rainy Street from another bar. And then they just go off into oblivion, right? And then days or weeks or, you know, a long time later, a body ends up floating or a body is found. And then it's correlated back to Rainy Street. And not to get facts, to ruin a good legend. But
that's what we're about, though, on this show. Not ruining legends, but demystifying things. And that's what we have to do, because headlines can take you down all kinds of rabbit holes, Greg. But it doesn't necessarily chasing the headline doesn't necessarily belie the facts of a case.
Right. Right. And in the case of Rainy Street, there's a lot of people drowning in Lady Bird Lake. And this has increased dramatically in the last 6 years.
Yeah.
So you look for correlations and things, right? You go, okay, the real growth on Rainy Street has been in the last 6 years.
Yeah.
And so you look at correlations at Lake Travis. Other than COVID, the amount of attended deaths as far as aquatic deaths on Lake Travis increases with the population.
Sure.
You know, the more people move out there, the more people are going to be drowning. And it's many of these things are just really sad. People that just don't know any better.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden they run into money and they go, oh, I'm going to buy a boat. All of a sudden they run into money and get some really money. I'm going to buy a lake house.
Yeah.
And the amount of things that go wrong.
Even right here in our city, right up against COVID was the public camping ordinance that allowed the homeless. Yep. And they like I lived right there in East Austin, you know, right there where all these things happened. And yeah, like that whole area forestry wise was very encamped by the homeless. And it was very interesting that you didn't find a bunch of homeless people drowning. What you were having was these young 20-year-old, like mid-20s, early 30-year-olds, things like that. People that were in decent physical health, knew how to swim, being found in water that's probably about waist deep.
Right.
You know? So it was really strange because, as populations pick up, those kind of deaths do pick up. But it was really funny that the people who at that point had really gathered around that lake property were not the people that were victimized by this.
Right. I think I have some notes over here. I think
please,
we have one out of, let's say, if we're going to go with like a standard, we're going to go with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 bodies that have been recovered from, let's say, downstream about Longhorn Dam.
Okay.
Up to that would be Lamar, right?
Sure.
So along that area to cross I-35 and that sort of stuff, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 out of those that are unidentified that were most likely homeless persons.
Okay.
You know, nobody reported. The rest of them, like you said, this is pretty much occurred. If you go with a canonical group of what we just identified, you're looking at essentially in 2022, 2023, 2024, of this increase of drownings.
Yeah.
We say drownings now,
deaths that are found deaths, in the water. Right.
So in things like this, if it's a suspicious death, that case will remain open. They will suspend it. In other words, they'll get the case. They'll work the case as best they can, collect all the evidence that they can. The body will go to the ME's office. They will conduct an autopsy, and they will do a toxicology. And it takes about 30, 40 days, get the toxicology back. And then you have a base of, all right, what is the evidence on the scene? Well, there's no evidence collected on scene. All we have is a body. They're fully clothed. They still have their wallet on them. They still have personal items in their pockets, still have a watch, rings, that sort of stuff. And the toxicology comes back with a certain level of ETOH, a certain level of alcohol in the bloodstream.
Okay.
And often, more often than not, there is also other drugs that would be, you know, party drugs that would be there, marijuana or ecstasy or something like that, right?
Sure.
Not to a level where it's like this person is going to pass out and you know, that's it.
Yeah.
But the real interesting thing about this, I say the interesting thing, oftentimes, like when I'm doing paranormal investigation, I typically don't look for evidence. I look for what's missing.
Sure.
What should be there, yes, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's like, what is that? So in this case, you know, in the autopsy, when you're first looking at a body on scene, you're looking for unusual, or you're looking for something that is, that should be there that is not. And in the cases of aquatic death, man, there's so many things that can go wrong in aquatic death, and the putrefaction is exaggerated and it's accelerated when somebody is in the water.
Sure.
So when you're looking for the standard things like post-mortem lividity and petechia and that sort of stuff, oftentimes that's exaggerated in the water. Or it can also be diluted in the water, depending on how the body was positioned and whether there was an actual water flow creating pressures on the body as the body decomposes. So there's a whole bunch of different things that go on with this. But the main thing is in the autopsy, I'm not saying that they did this with the folks that we listed here in their autopsies, but typically you basically skin somebody, because what you're looking to for is if you have you know, very shallow bruising on the skin caused by post-mortem lividity, the pooling of the blood in the person's body, you're going to have to pull that skin off in order to look to see if there's deeper bruises going on in the muscles.
Sure.
And in these cases, there's nothing, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know how you want to look at this, There's nothing that the medical examiner or the homicide detectives with Austin Police Department have looked at to see, look, there's four small bruises on the back of this person's tricep and one big bruise on their bicep, as in someone grabbed a hold of them and caused that bruising, right? There's nothing like that. There's no correlation or consistency with the bruises that would relate back to a particular implement that they were struck with. There's no injuries like skull fractures or things like that. Being an aquatic death situation in the water, you may be able to get fingernail scrapings, but probably not. It's that's that water, that solution, the medium, probably diluted, whatever that is. So it's a real challenge to do that. But the standard things that somebody would look at in aquatic death that would indicate that it was a murder just haven't surfaced in these investigations.
Interesting.
And the other big problem, and I'm not disparaging Austin Police Department at all when I say this.
Yeah.
And believe me, if there's a bad cop or an incompetent cop, I will be the first one to point him out.
You trained
those guys make us all look like idiots.
Yeah.
So, when you're looking at these particular things, the last thing the cops want to do is go, yeah, well, we can't figure it out. We're going to move on.
Yeah,
they do in a case like this, and they know that the media and other hobbyists are watching them and then doing podcasts and that sort of, you know,
yeah,
that sort of stuff. They don't want to get caught with their pants down. So they're going to cover all of those bases and follow the evidence. And if the evidence, you know, shine light on something, it's a shoulder shrug and you go, you know, death was an accident. And the cause of death was drowning. And
now
the real problem with that, and like I said, I'm not saying that Austin Police Department has done this, but I have worked personally with detectives that are like this.
Mm.
They see a drowning and immediately, this is an accident.
Yeah.
And they work their case just to manage their caseload and to clear it as an accident, because in their magical, you know, clairvoyant mind, because they have so much experience that they don't need evidence to make a decision.
My hunch is good enough.
Oh, this was an accident, and they just move on. Yeah. They don't ask for any special testing. They don't do, you know, a big canvas of a lot of the witnesses or any family members. You know, they don't delve deep. The first thing they do is just call victim services and tell the person that's typically the number one suspect, I'm so sorry, your wife drowned. Let me get you victim services. Let me get this for you. Let me get that for you. When in fact, you know, he's the number one suspect you're not doing it.
Thing. Immediately. Yeah. The like, if you have a spouse or significant other that, is, and especially if that person is pregnant, that increases the likelihood of it being spouse or significant other almost by 100-fold. It's crazy. Like the fact that death by significant other is literally the highest cause of death of pregnant women is frightening. That is a frightening fact.
You look at, you know, the amount of women that have been taking baths their entire life, and all of a sudden their mortality triples between the ages of 47 and 60.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what happens after 60? Well, it normalizes again. Well, why would it happen between 47 and 60? It's called menopause.
Yeah.
And it's called a husband that is tired of putting up with it. And horribly. She slipped in the bathtub.
Yeah.
She slipped. You go up with a, you know, with a baseball bat, hit her over the, you know, the head and throw her in the bathtub, run the water there. And it's like, oh my God, she slipped in the bathtub.
This is not an MO advocacy episode, by the way.
Yeah. it's hard to prove that
is not the case.
How are you going to unprove that?
Yeah. And you know, especially when you're talking about, because this is something that we've talked about not only privately together, but on the show, that idea of walking into a case with your mind made up. I mean, whether it's paranormal or otherwise, if you walk into the case with your filter already polished, you're going to have an issue. You know,
man,
you're
going to
have
an issue with
how you look
at
evidence, everything.
Yeah, I worked with a particular detective that's exactly the way this guy was. Mm. Every time he would show up, he was smarter than everybody in the room. He would roll his eyes if you, hey, you know, you might want to check out this or that. And he'd just go, yeah, all right. You know, that kind of guy should be moved out of the unit, should be sent back to training, and probably have some sort of mental health evaluation because, and you're going to have, you know, across the board in any career field, you're going to have that 10% of just dysfunction, just manipulative genius, you know, that just kind of belittles everybody. And it's terrifying when you have cops that are like that.
Yeah.
You know,
well, especially whenever you're talking about cases like this, where, you know, families want answers, all kinds of things. When you're talking about a case where, once again, it's not like their blood alcohol content was beyond means. It's not like they had, they may have once again have had a little bit of something in them, but it's not like they were like laced with GHB or, you know, roofied or something like that. Like Rohibinol wasn't found in their system. Nothing where it's like, let me walk you out of the club in that kind of impaired way and do whatever I want. That doesn't seem to be the case with these victims.
No, there's two. There's two guys that went missing and were found pretty quickly afterwards that were seriously injured. One of them almost died. He was near one of the bridges, and the hypothesis that
I didn't realize that there were survivors amongst these cases.
Yeah, there is this one particular one. The hypothesis by Austin Police Department is that, you know, he was really inebriated and was walking across one of the bridges and fell off the bridge. And his impact down there in the gravel and, you know, small trees and stuff, he was injured enough to where he could not even get himself out of there, and he couldn't hardly call for help. And somebody came by much later and saw this body and realized, oh, he's still alive. And so they got him out of there. He does not have recollection of what happened that night. So whether it was so much alcohol on board, he did, you know, the blackout drunk. You know, whether it was GHB or something else, but he has no information. The other one that was recovered has no information whatsoever. And that's one of those things. It's like, if you fall off a bridge, typically it's not going to look like you were beaten up with a bat. You know, you're going to have several injuries, but they're going to be consistent with the fall.
Yeah.
Not, you know, injuries all over your body. Well, he had injuries all over his body.
Interesting.
And so, you know, basically it's like, oh yeah, he's got injuries everywhere. And because, I mean, there is, and that's one of the things that I taught, at the academy was, as a detective, there is a point in your case where you just shrug your shoulders and go,
I don't know.
I have no clue.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That folder, I'm, you know, just fold it up, put in a file, close, and that's it. And I, you know, because of the amount of news that APD is getting on this thing, it is my belief that those guys are doing a competent job over there. If it is a serial killer, we typically look for modus operandi, right?
Yeah.
Some repeated stuff, like he always shoots them in the back of the head, or he always strangles them, or he always does something. In these, they have closed these cases, which means that you can go and do an open records request and read the case from front to back. If they felt there was any strange occurrences in these cases,
those
cases would stay open.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they would be closed, but they would stay open, and you would not be able to do an open records request and read that case, because there would typically be two or three things that only the suspect is going to know. And the detective needs to know what those are and not share them with anybody. But when he interviews somebody that is a suspect, that's, you know, if that person knows about those things, boom, you got them. And it's a crazy thing. People, I went back to school years ago and to get my degree in psychology until I realized I don't want to hear your problems.
Yeah.
I figured out.
Done.
I'm not going to be a good psychologist, right? but in that, you know, you look at the behavior of people and you become much more of a humanitarian as far as, hey, man, people have bad days. People have bad weeks. People have years.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that that's who they are.
Yep.
The yogurt shop murders back in the 90s, four teenage girls murdered, stacked their bodies in the yogurt shop, caught the yogurt shop on fire, burned it to the ground. Fire department responds. They shove thousands and thousands of gallons of water into this crime scene. They don't realize that it's a quadruple murder, right, of teenage girls. And so they pump this water in there and dilute much of any evidence that would have been there. At that point, Austin Police Department goes in there, and the Austin Fire Department goes in and realizes, oh my God, we have, you know, these bodies in here. Well, so how much more horrific can you get? You know that these girls were raped, and no telling whatever else happened with them during that.
Yeah.
They were all murdered gangland at execution style in the back of the head with a gun. And then they caught the place on fire to destroy any evidence. And they did, the perpetrators that did this did a really good job of destroying the evidence. Austin Police Department at the time, I don't think anybody would be offended or argue with what I'm about to say, did an absolutely horrible job managing that crime scene and conducting the initial investigation.
Yeah.
They overlooked so much stuff that, I mean, they didn't even, as far as search the dumpsters around that that shopping center to see if, you know, the suspects threw anything in the garbage.
Mm.
That's something that you would do. And I am second guessing, I'm Monday morning quarterbacking on these guys. But the reason I bring this up is we're talking modus operandi.
Yeah.
And we're talking the Rainy Street people that have been, recovered, drowned all over Lady Bird Lake. 42 people came forward to the Austin Police Department and confessed that they were the ones that killed the girls in the yogurt shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
42 idiots. So here's the cops. The cop gets the case, the yogurt shop case. He's got an arson case. He's got probably a robbery case involved in that. You have tampering with evidence case. You have 1, 2, 3, 4 murder cases. You probably have 4 sexual assault cases in all of that. Now, it's one case, but you have to work every one of those in order to be able to put this thing together. And now you have 42 other people that come forward saying, hey, I was the one that raped and killed those teenage girls. Mm. Now I have 42 other cases that I have to exculpate. I have to investigate those people, find out what they were doing that night, what their background is, and remove them from the suspect list.
Wow.
Yeah. So this case turned into, you know, they're working 60 cases or plus. How do you do that? And when you have idiots that come forward trying to get their name in the paper, they don't like the cops and they're just jacking with the cops. You know, I don't know what their personal motivation is to come forward and say, I am a child rapist and a child arsonist.
Yeah.
Wow. How jacked up do people have to be?
Well, and you know, that's kind of the, like we were talking about a while ago, whenever Chester Moore and I have considered the fact that maybe this is some kind of dark MO that's traded on the dark web, because there are those horrible, horrible individuals out there in the world that want to see what their evil has wrought.
Right.
You know, they want to, like, that's their thrill, is the aftermath. Not even what happens when it happens, but watching people try to catch up and try to figure it out and things like that. And yeah, that's where you end up with, you know, cases like the Zodiac Killer is famous for the fact that they actively put misinformation out to assure the fact that, like, when people came in and said, oh, I did this and that, it's like, okay, awesome, thank you for your report. And they immediately know that that person is not the Zodiac Killer. Like, immediately they can weed that out just by them sharing one detail that they shared in the newspaper on purpose.
Well, in the Rainy Street drownings here, for them to close the cases and make those cases available for public, review, pretty much that's how confident these cops are that these are accidents. They're just like, nah, this is an accident. I'm closing a case. And here it is. However, if you have somebody that's drunk, and you are a predator and you're hanging out on the trails around, Lady Bird Lake.
Yep.
You guy comes stumbling up, you create a conversation with him and it's like, yeah, you know, and then y'all walking along and then it's like, yeah, I'm going to go look closer to the water, and you get closer to the water and you just decide you want to, you being a serial killer predator, you decide to push the guy in the water. He's in full clothes. You push him in the water. Is that going to leave a bruise on that person? Probably not. If they wrestle around, it might leave a bruise, but you push them in the water. Now, if you know Lady Bird Lake well enough, and it would be easy to do, so much of Lady Bird Lake comes out from the bank, and it'll go out at a slow slope, maybe 10, 15 feet, and then it'll drop to 14, 15 feet, and it kind of stair steps down from there. Lady Bird Lake got Town Lake. It got closed by the city of Austin years and years ago when a family was out swimming and their two daughters, their two young, I want to say these kids were like 7, 8 years old, something like that, drowned there in the lake. And they petitioned to close the lake to swimmers because they said it was too dangerous. Well, it's not too dangerous. It's too dangerous for a set of parents that aren't watching their kids and haven't sent their kids to swim class.
Yeah.
Then it's very dangerous, but,
so is the ditch at that point.
Yeah. Lady Bird Lake is not a dangerous lake to swim in. People say, oh, the duckweed, it comes and gets you and wraps around your, describe it like it's the Kraken down at the bottom and the tentacles are coming to get you.
Yeah. Like it's the ooze from Creepshow 2.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now I've been in those duckweed beds down there. And if you bury yourself down in there and you're not a good swimmer and you start kicking around and panicking, that's going to create some drag on you. That's not going to be assisting you to the surface, but it doesn't grab you and pull you down or anything like that. But when you look at that, if somebody wanted to drown somebody, swim that well in full clothes and with their shoes on.
Yes. Yes.
So you push them in the water. They have no bruise at that point. And if you know where to push them in the water to where it's deep enough where it's over 9 feet, 10 feet. And you just keep pushing them in the water, splashing water at them or whatever, and there's that possibility depending on how drunk somebody is. But otherwise, you're going to have to grab a hold of them and hold them underwater. And there's very typical bruising for a drowning like that.
Well, and, it may not be crazy. Don't get me wrong. But what people tend to forget, especially if they're not local, they don't understand this. You hear the term lake. You're thinking still water, man.
Right.
There's only one natural lake in Texas, Caddo Lake. The rest of them are all dammed lakes, things like that. But this is not a lake. It's actively just a part of the Colorado River. Like, the Lady Bird Lake is a flowing body of water. It's not a still body of water that drains into the river. It's an active part of the river. So... yeah, like I just popped up whenever you were talking earlier about the attended deaths. Like literally 2 days ago, May 3rd, there was a paddle boarder that went under and never came up.
Yeah.
And that's because of the currents. It's not because they fell into a lake, you know, it's because they fell into a river. And when you fall into a river, that's a different story. You're in a moving body of water. Things get very disorienting very quickly if you're not just in splash depth water, you know?
Especially if you're not a, good swimmer. It's,
yeah,
it is. It always drives me. It's really weird to me. But I grew up around water, and I was swimming at 2.
Yeah.
And
my son is a strong swimmer. His dad is not.
It always really surprises me when, you know, I meet people. It's like, no, I don't know how to swim. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
That would be like one of the first things I would do to a child is teach them how to swim.
Yeah.
The doggy paddle. Yeah. Just a floating doggy paddle around.
Yep.
And it's so easy. Or it can be very challenging to people that are very muscular. They don't have a lot of body fat on them.
Yeah.
They will sink if they don't have a good technique and breath control.
People ask me all the time, like, you have size 16 feet. Do you think you'd be a natural swimmer? It's like, man, that's like having 3.5 pounds of meat on the end of your legs. That's right. That's just extra weight to have to kick around.
I think
that
it's makes more than 3.5 pounds.
That makes you makes you tired faster. It doesn't mean you're a better swimmer.
Yeah. But walk around with big flippers all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah. That's an interesting point to bring up. The fact that it's a moving body of water. So if you push somebody in it who is drunk, disoriented, things like that. Yeah. You push them in deep enough. They could get caught on a branch underneath. They could get caught on a rock, all kinds of things. And once again, be in a flowing body of water that may not, it's not like rapid flowing. You know, but it's moving enough that it'll move you.
Yeah, the a lot of people don't understand the Highland Lake chain. So the idea that Austin got flooded multiple times and everybody knew the problem. And so they came up with some ideas. They're going to, you know, dam off the Colorado River at different levels in order to slow the water down and also to provide water for, you know, sport fishing or, you know, just farming and all that down in, down further the Colorado River getting toward, the coast. There's a lot of people don't know this. There's a bunch of rice farms down there.
Yeah.
And that's what actually Lake Travis was built for. Buchanan Dam, Lake LBJ, Lake Buchanan, Inks Lake, what am I thinking of? Lady Bird Lake, Lake Austin, Lower Colorado River.
Yep.
All of this is the flow of the Lower Colorado River, but specifically all of the lakes in that chain, except for Lake Travis, is designed to stay at a constant level.
Yeah.
Now we know they don't always because of droughts and things like that, but you will see Lake Travis do the most fluctuations because its job is to hold water upstream and to keep water downstream. So it's going to fluctuate like crazy. And that's a funny thing when people go out to Lake Travis and you know, buy their $3 million lake with waterfront property in the next year.
Their boathouse is like
gravel pit.
Yeah, their boathouse is like 50 yards away from the bank out in the middle of the riverbed.
And they're madder than hell, and they get a hold
rightfully
of LCRA. So. Hey, you're letting out on water. It's like, man, you might need to read the fine print on this because that's not what this lake is
for. You're living there right building. Where it's designed to do that.
Yeah, they're actually building another lake.
Yep.
And if it works out, Lake Travis will become an even level lake as long as we don't have droughts or whatever.
Well, and with those things in mind, especially because, yes, like we said, there is quite the homeless population that lives around the lake. Things like even right there at Rainy Street, all kinds of things. But have there been any kind of profile that these people match? Anything like that? Is there anything other than the fact that they were just found in the water that ties them together in any kind of way?
Yes. So the profile would be a white male, Hispanic or white male, an Anglo male. Now, the funny thing is some of these talking heads and documentarian type folks that decided to do some research on this stuff is they said, yeah, you know, all of the victims had brown hair and brown eyes, you know, so that's a thing. It's like, you need to look up statistics, man. Majority of the people on the planet have brown hair and brown eyes. You can't throw that in as one of the, yeah, you can't throw
as
that
a distinctive
in there.
Feature.
You know, if they were all, you know, red hair and green eyes, something's going on there.
Yeah,
that would be a big flag.
Yeah.
Right. Somebody. So you look at this. So the standard thing is Anglo male, brown hair, brown eyes, partying around Rainy Street, usually with friends, disappears from the friends, doesn't say goodbye or anything, just kind of wanders off. And then is later found in Lady Bird Lake, and a high amount of these folks that were found there are also gay.
Okay.
So you have to throw in, all right, is somebody looking for gay males?
Sure.
Well, the thing is everybody,
there's also a couple
that wants to be politically correct will say, yeah, everybody should be equal. Women and men should be equal. Well, it's a simple fact that men participate in more dangerous activities than women do.
Yeah. Yeah, we're pretty stupid en masse.
Yeah. And, you know, back in the 80s, cops at night would always go by roadside parks and check out the roadside parks, especially the bathrooms at roadside parks, because there was a population of gay men that were, you know, that's where their liaisons were, was at these roadside parks and stuff. So that was a huge thing. That was like a thing. It was. This is not just being mean to a population.
No, when I lived in Maine all of a decade ago, the park right down the road from my house had a no cruising sign.
Yeah.
No cruising.
Yeah, there you go. That's the deal. Dillard's department store back in the 80s and 90s, gay men would go to the bathrooms of Dillard's department store at Highland Mall.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And that we ended up arresting, I want to say, a dozen people having lewd conduct in the bathrooms at Dillard's. So there is a underground communication of where to hook up, where to meet up.
Sure.
There was a spot at Lamar and Palmer Lane. When you go there and you drive through there, it's like, where would you meet up there? Well, back in that little neighborhood, there's an actual, like, park trail that's maybe as wide as two people's houses right there. And it's just a little trail, and it's got a sign. And the trail doesn't go very far. It's maybe a mile. I don't even think it goes a mile. Guess what? People started noticing there's all these cars parking along the side of the road. All these cars parking along the side of the road. What's going on? Why are all these strange people coming into our neighborhood? This was a huge thing. We ended up doing a sting operation to try to figure out what was going on, because all of these, military age males were parking there, getting out and taking a walk down the trail by themselves. Well, guess what? There was some action going on in the woods out in this neighborhood. And so there are behaviors.
Sure.
That whether you're straight or whether you're gay, that are outside the norm. So you can't just discount. Are the trails of Lady Bird Lake at night a good place for someone who wants a hookup to meet people? Is that where a certain group of people go?
Sure.
And if it is, I think it's probably slowing down, because I think everybody knows, oh, you don't go down the trails on Lady Bird Lake, you end up getting killed and thrown in the water.
Yeah, and that Rainy Street area definitely does have a couple of alternative lifestyle locations. You know, it's pretty hip in general. And yeah, is abutting the lake. So the idea that, you could quietly dismiss yourself from the noisy bar to go somewhere quiet, right there adjoining or abutting the location, would be pretty easy. You know, that would be pretty simple. So you don't necessarily have to look, once again, for a ripper that is targeting a swath of people or things like that. Despite the fact that there seems to be a few key things that a lot of these victims have in common, as far as alternative lifestyle, things like that. But once again, that area is well populated with that, and that's a normal course of action there to begin with. So.
Yeah, and something that most cops don't know about, because most cops don't have degrees in psychology or whatever. There's things that you have to look at as far as behavior and not discount what may be happening. You have type one errors in judgment and type two errors in judgment. Psychology term. A type one error in judgment is you have a rifle, you're walking along through the woods, and a bush rustles over here. You turn and look. You go close in on the bush, and you realize, oh, it's just the wind blowing the bush. Well, you do that enough times, you're walking through the woods, and the bush rustles, and you go, it's just the wind. And a tiger jumps out and bites your face off. That's a type two error. So you always want to err on the side of type one errors and be overly cautious on what's going on and just, not discount something.
Just shoot the bush.
Takes care of both things, the wind and the tiger.
That's right.
So as a homicide detective, as a missing persons detective, as any kind of major crimes detective, you want to make type one errors all the time. You want to assume that Ted Bundy is killing these guys, and you want to work your case to prove that he's not, as opposed to proving that it was an accident. Because that's the thing that just drives me insane is cops are so overwhelmed right now with caseloads that they're doing more case management than they are solving crimes. They just want to get this thing off of their desk so they can move on to the next one because they're buried. And the whole defund the police, the whole, all of the stuff that's happened.
I brought it up a second ago, but even before the defund the police, things like that, like APD was hitting rock to pretty hard a few years ago, back in 2016 when their DNA freezer went out and I mean, ruined tons of evidence in sexual crimes, investigations, murders, all kinds of things. And that's just a thing, folks. Like I hate to tell you, but if it's DNA, it's being stored in a freezer. So it has long-term storage. It doesn't take long for that to deprecate, you know? For it to be utterly unusable, like you said, like you want to get away with murder, go do it in water, go make it happen in water. As soon as that frozen stuff starts to thaw, like it's almost deprecated to begin with and unusable.
And it's really funny, like in that particular case, it's like, let's say you have a sexual assault once every 2 weeks,
sure,
in Austin. So you have a DNA refrigerator or freezer that you have somewhere back in the corner of the evidence room somewhere. And a mouse is messing around and it's chewing on the cord and pulls the cord out of the wall or whatever happens, right? The compressor goes out or whatever. And the evidence guy, you know, there's no checklist to go, when I show up in the morning, I need to check.
Is the freezer on?
Yeah. So you only know it when, I got another envelope to, you know, of DNA stuff I need to put in the freezer. And you go over there and it's just soup in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And so while many times it is the cop's fault, sometimes technology or whatever just kind of drops the ball and then you discover it. We had a situation where we had evidence from 40 years back.
Oh,
because
wow.
It was, yeah, it was ordered by the court to maintain this evidence. So there's a corner of the evidence room, the evidence warehouse, where they had that stored. Well, I ended up getting assigned down there and doing an audit of a bunch of the old cases. Well, I go back there and realize that the roof right above where all this old evidence was has been leaked for years.
Oh, God.
And that evidence, every bit of it is just
deprecated,
has been soaked multiple times and dried out multiple times and has mold and everything growing all over this stuff.
God.
Right? Which immediately you got to, you know, get all that stuff out of there, clean everything up, and try to maintain, you know, don't do anything to the evidence, leave it the way it is. But try to maintain that, you know, it doesn't get worse, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just all kinds of stuff.
Well, and you know, to bring this home at the end of it, it's one of those, once again, headlines are amazing. I've said it on my show for a while. If I would probably have a much huger audience if I was willing to just go down rabbit holes, Greg. If I was willing to just say things as though they're fact. But my show is here to help demystify these topics. My show is here to help allay people's fears in communities, things like that. So it's one of those, like, yes, we've talked about the Rainy Street murders. We've talked about their possible connection to other things that were strange like this, much like the feet that were popping up in British Columbia for a while, you know, that were just washing ashore on rivers and things like
crazy,
that,
man.
Where crazy things like that happen. And it's like, what did like the did the foot hospital barge like sink in the Puget? Like, it's, you know, what happened?
What happened?
And like you said, even detectives get to the point of what happened here. And they put it up, they hold it up, until other things come along. These are of the fact. And are you in conclusion with the police department, Greg, or do you agree that these are good enough investigative wise to be closed in that kind of way?
So the ones that I've read, I've only read four.
Okay.
The ones that I've read, I would have closed them. For the simple fact that we just did,
okay,
that in these cases, there's no physical evidence that would support the idea of this was a murder. That doesn't mean it wasn't a murder.
Sure, sure.
It just means there's, it would be different if the individual was sober. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon and he disappeared from his house.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Midnight, intoxicated, dark, in a higher crime area next to water and you drown. Yeah. There's just,
yeah.
And it's not that I don't want us to have a serial killer.
I kind of don't want us to have a serial killer. I'm okay with avoiding the reputation.
William Sidney Porter. What was his? He wrote the Gift of the Magi. Mm. He was a writer here in Austin. He had a really cool pen name. I always forget his pen name, but he said during the 18. Oh, Henry. He said, he wrote a thing during the 1883 to 1885. There was a serial killer here in Austin. And he wrote, other than the actions of the servant girl Annihilator, Austin is drearily boring.
Yeah.
Right? So he was all for having a serial killer as well. So.
Yeah, right. You got to do something to keep the doors open. You know, it's once again, to help demystify these things is what I'm here for. And I've wanted to have this conversation in a greater and deeper way for a long time. And I'm very, very happy for the fact that you were able to help facilitate that, Greg. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I think it's in any of these cases, always have an open mind and know that things could change. All it takes is one little piece of evidence to change all of these from drownings to murders. So,
yeah, precisely. It is strange. It is strange that there are a few connections. But once again, it's one of those, whether you're talking normal or paranormal, Greg, correlation is not causation.
Nope.
You know, and you really do have to keep that in the forefront of your mind all the time. Otherwise, like, good Lord, the rabbit holes you'll go down in the world. So I want to thank you so much for your time today. I was so happy to be able to make this happen. Let everybody know where they can go to follow you, follow your work, where they can go to get all of your books. We'll, of course, be adding your books to the Curious Realm store. But let everybody know where they can go for everything that is Greg Lawson.
Thanks, man. It's my pleasure. You can go to theparanormaldetective.com. There you'll be able to find all the books. You can go on to Amazon. I have an Amazon author page, and you can find all my books on Amazon as well. I'm on Facebook. You can find me there easy, and on YouTube for the Paranormal 60 and also Three Gorillas podcast. So thanks.
Fantastic. That is absolutely awesome. Once again, I'm so happy to have you here. I am entirely excited for this episode, man. It's always great seeing you at conferences. Where is your next conference actually?
So my next conference will be up in Utah at Phenomicon, which is a pretty big one. It's very impressive the way that they run that one. Here in about a week or so, I'm going to be up at Haunted Hill House in Mineral Wells. We're doing a kind of a meet and greet talk and then an investigation so people can actually buy tickets to conduct the investigation up there and stay the night should you dare. At Haunted Hill House. And honestly, all BS aside, I spent one night by myself in that place, and I have no reason to do that ever again. It was not a pleasant experience.
Wow. So. Wow. Well, we will definitely have to have you on to talk about the Hill House experience. Thank you so much again,
Coolman.
Greg. Greatly appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective, at theparanormaldetective.com. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find not only all of our episodes, but also the store full of books, videos, classes, all kinds of things from our guest, as well as your copy of the Curious Research Field and Observation Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, or UFO, UAP technology, stop on by and get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. It is your pocket field log to write down your data from investigations as it happens in real time, so that come the day that you need to shake hands with science, you have good data to be able to do so. Thank you so much for your time, everybody. It's always great talking with you. It's always great having you and your open hearts, your open minds. Without that, the conversation does not happen. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.